ready to hear from you, and would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I understand that it's 30 minutes divided by the two between the two parties, so 15 minutes each.
Yes, sir.
I've never done. Yeah, so I've never done telephonic, but I assume they apply the same way. So yeah, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'll
yes,
try
sir.
To look at a clock. And first, so shall I begin?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I'd like to say I'm Andrew Seabach. I have been appointed to represent Brandon Winder in this appeal. I would like to apologize to the court for not being able to appear last week because of sinus infection and strep throat, which I still have, but I appreciate the opportunity to appear today. I think that there are two basic issues before the court on this appeal. The one is collateral estoppel, which was raised by the trial counsel. This is a perjury case. And the other, I've asked that an issue that was not preserved, at least as far as I can tell, in the trial record, be considered by the court under Rule 5A:18, the ends of justice exception, and that is that the Commonwealth at the perjury trial failed to prove all the elements necessary for perjury, and despite that, Mr. Winder was convicted of perjury and received sentences. A review of the trial transcript makes it clear, in my opinion, that neither the trial court nor any of the counsel participating in the trial knew what the rules of perjury were. It is still extant law that in order to prove perjury, you must have two witnesses testifying to the perjurious statement, or as the Commonwealth or the Attorney General has pointed out in the brief, if they only have one witness, they must have corroborating evidence, which I don't think was present either, but it's pretty clear from the trial record that the judge and the counsel didn't even think about that. But let me step back. The perjury involves Mr. Winder in a previous trial testifying as to he had a failure to appear during the proceedings, and when he was asked about this under oath, both at a bond hearing and during the trial, because he had a failure to appear charge, he testified that he was on the day in question at a hospital receiving stitches. And at least at the trial level, he presented a document that appears to be a billing notice from the hospital telling him that they have to do some things with Medicaid. I noted in the Commonwealth's brief that they said that this was not in the joint appendix. I'm not sure, but it looks to me, and I have no quibble with it, but I just want to point this document out to the court, that it is in my joint appendix, at least it looks like it is, at page 314. But it was attached by the Commonwealth without objection by me later in the proceedings before the court, so you should have it. It is important to note, and this goes to the collateral estoppel argument, that the trial court ultimately dismissed the failure to appear charge. The Attorney General's office notes that we cannot know precisely why the failure to appear was dismissed. We argue that, and the trial counsel for Mr. Winder in the perjury case, should be obvious to your honors, the Commonwealth brought the perjury charge alleging that Mr. Winder lied about being at the hospital. At the perjury trial, they brought in a witness who is the custodian of records of Sentara Hospitals, who's testified that she could not find any record of Mr. Winder having been treated on the day in question. However, she did testify that the document that Mr. Winder produced looked very much like the documents that Sentara produces. She noted that there was a code number that was incorrect, but she noted that that code number did relate to another patient. So it wasn't as if the document came up with a number that was non-existent. It came up with a real patient in the Sentara records. At any rate, the Commonwealth chose to charge him with perjury for lying about where he was. At the perjury trial, the only witness they produced was the records custodian from Sentara. The Attorney General's brief argues that the prosecutor of the original trial, Mr. Caro, is another witness. I disagree with that because Mr. Caro cannot testify as to where Mr. Winder was on the day in question. He's only testifying as to the fact that Mr. Winder testified as he did. There's no dispute to that, and that doesn't prove the perjury. That simply says that he testified in court, and that's the issue in question. I would also note that...
Mr. Seabock, if I can interrupt you, this is Judge Huff. Kathy Lehoucek, the risk manager, had testified. Did she testify just at the underlying case?
Yes, she did not testify. The Commonwealth realized their problem, so they used a different witness at the perjury trial. But both witnesses from Sentara testified that the document appeared genuine. And the first one you mentioned, I can't pronounce her name, she didn't even say that the account number was incorrect. She simply said that it appeared genuine and she could not say that it was a forgery. Accordingly, Judge Mary Jane Hall dismissed the charge. And so our collateral estoppel argument is, may I go on?
Yes, please.
Okay. Our collateral estoppel argument is that the FTA charge was premised upon the material fact that he was not at the hospital, that he was not in court. The perjury charge is premised upon the fact that he's lying about where he was, the same exact material fact, that he was not at the hospital. Therefore, since the Commonwealth lost at the trial level, at the first trial, on that exact issue with respect to the fifth FTA charge, they are stopped from arguing that in the perjury case. That was what the trial attorney argued. Now, the other thing I wanted to point out is that even the witness that they brought to the perjury case, Ms. Roses, is not a witness who can testify as to the falsity of Mr. Winder's testimony. She can only testify and only did testify as to what the records that she checked showed. She doesn't know. She cannot say that Mr. Winder was not at the facility that he said he was. She can only say her records show that. I would posit, for example, that finding the people who were working that day and asking them and bringing them in would have been much more effective evidence and would have been proper witnesses to prove the falsity of Mr. Winder's testimony. So not only do they only have one witness, they don't have any witnesses. And the law is the law. Now, the Attorney General argues that they have corroborating evidence because the letter in question was deemed to be false by the trial judge. The problem there is that, one, I believe the trial judge is clearly in error in that, and I would ask the court to look at that letter because, and I'm not sure if the court can do that at this moment, but it's at page 314 of the joint appendix. If one looks at this letter, there is nothing in the trial transcript of the perjury trial where they ask Ms. Roses whether any of the contents of this letter is accurate. For example, is Hannah Richardson the correct person to contact? Is the phone number the correct person to contact? Is the font the correct number? Is it correct that Medicaid would have done these things that they say? Did they contact Medicaid? Did they do anything to prove that this letter is a false letter other than to point out that there appears to be another patient's number on this letter. And there is no reason to believe that that could not be a clerical error. They have not provided any evidence that this letter is not valid. So this is not a corroborating letter. This is simply another piece of evidence. And so I believe that the rule is very clear on perjury, that where someone has sworn an oath, the law says that they have to get more than one person under oath to testify that it's false, and they haven't done that, and the corroborating evidence is simply not there. Now, the elephant in the room, I think I have 3 minutes left. I don't have the benefit of the colored lights. The elephant in the room, I'm sorry?
By my calculation, you're at about 8 or 9 minutes right now. I'm keeping track.
Oh, really? Well, but that's not including my rebuttal. I'll just plow on. So, the elephant in the room is that this was not raised at trial, that they did not meet the elements of the crime itself, of perjury. So I have asked that the court apply the ends of justice exception, and the Commonwealth has pointed out that this is a rare exception, and I have also acknowledged that, And I have attempted to meet all of the court's requirements to have that exception recognized and applied. We've raised it for the first time in our briefs, which is the only time we could do that. We have pointed out that if we are correct, that the elements of the crime of perjury were not proved at trial, Mr. Winder is going to suffer a grave injustice in that he will be convicted of the felony that he did not commit. And I believe under the Jimenez case, unfortunately I don't have it right in front of me, we would be eligible for consideration of this issue. Give me one moment. Of course, Redmond controls, but under Jimenez it says, while it's the rare case, you can consider an assignment of error not preserved at trial. In order to avail ourselves of that, the defendant must affirmatively show that a miscarriage of justice has occurred, not that a miscarriage might have occurred. I think the trial transcript clearly demonstrates nobody at the trial even considered that the elements of perjury were not being proved. They don't have the two witnesses, and they don't have sufficient proof of corroboration that he was not at the hospital. They didn't bother, frankly. I hate to say it, but the Commonwealth didn't do their job. They didn't do it.
Excuse me. And you are entering your rebuttal time, but let me ask one more question. Don't you also have an ends of justice argument? If your estoppel argument is correct, then he could not have been prosecuted for this crime of perjury anyway, and therefore would have been convicted of a crime that he was not susceptible to.
Right, but that was preserved by the trial counsel when she argued it at the perjury trial, so I don't see that as falling under the ends of justice exception.
Okay.
And I will save my time for rebuttal.
All right. Very well, thank you. Ms. Johnson?
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Victoria Johnson for the Commonwealth. I'll just say briefly as a housekeeping matter, I mentioned the Pijor case that is, I think, pretty well dealing with the same issues. That has been scheduled for argument at the November session of the Supreme Court of Virginia, just to make the court aware of that, because I think that case could have an effect on this one. But moving to the merits of this case, I submit that the collateral estoppel doctrine does not apply here. Simply because, as the trial court found at the perjury trial, the court that heard the failure to appear charge had very broad discretion here. The court did not have to reach the ultimate issue of fact that we're discussing. That was whether the defendant was actually at the hospital on the day he did not appear at court. And, in fact,
that was the only excuse that was offered, though, wasn't it?
It was. However, the court could have simply decided not to convict him of the charge, because under the statute, the court has the discretion to do that when the court believes that substantial justice would not, and the efficiency of the courts would not be reached. So here there is...
Ms. Johnson, am I correct that what you're essentially saying is by the judge saying that she had reasonable doubt, that's different than making a specific factual finding that he was at the hospital?
Yes, Judge Attlee, what I'm saying. I believe that was Judge Attlee. I apologize if I was wrong. Okay, I thought so. But yes, Your Honor, that's exactly what I'm saying. And the collateral estoppel doctrine is exceedingly narrow. And unless you can say without a doubt, unless you're certain that the former trial rested on this exact same question of fact, then collateral estoppel doesn't apply. And that is really my collateral estoppel argument in a nutshell.
That's how you distinguish the Cevico case, then?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. In Cevico, there was a very kind of narrow factual universe. You know, that was I believe, driving on suspended charge, and really there's only two elements to that. You have to be driving and it has to be suspended. And the defendant was acquitted because he said that he wasn't driving, and the trial court in the driving on suspended prosecution believed the defendant. And that was pretty apparent on the record there. That's not the same situation we have here. Although Mr. Winder told the court at the failure to appear trial that he was at the hospital that day, the trial court at the failure to appear trial did not specifically make a factual finding that she believed that, and accordingly acquitted him.
But by not acquitting him, by, in effect, saying the evidence is not strong enough to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he's guilty of failure to appear, and given that was the only issue and the only excuse, doesn't that fall squarely in Sabeco?
I submit that it does not, Your Honor, for several reasons. Again, as the trial court at the perjury trial held, that court has absolute discretion in applying the failure to appear statute. The court may have determined that it just wasn't appropriate in this case, that justice and the efficiency of the courts would not be served. The court may have also determined that since the custodian of the records had not come in to testify at the failure to appear trial, that the Commonwealth simply hadn't carried its burden and acquitted on that ground. So there's a couple of different ways that the case could have played out at the failure to appear trial, and the record doesn't establish which one. And in order for collateral estoppel to apply, the record has to establish that the exact same question of fact, that ultimate question of fact, was decided at the prior proceeding. And here, the record just doesn't rise to that level, and that is why collateral estoppel simply does not apply in this case. And again, you know, I cited several cases in my brief, most notably the Rubian case from the Fourth Circuit. You know, there's good policy reasons that a court shouldn't hold that an acquittal is a bar to a subsequent prosecution for perjury, simply because that would put a premium on perjury, in the Fourth Circuit's words. So here, I submit that the record doesn't show that the trial court at the failure to appear trial made a specific factual finding on this issue, and therefore the Commonwealth was not stopped from prosecuting Mr. Winder for perjury at the subsequent proceeding. Moving to the sufficiency prong, if I may, if there's more questions about collateral estoppel, I'm happy to answer them. Okay. Moving to sufficiency, Your Honors, the opposing counsel, you know, candidly admits that this was not raised at trial and he's proceeding under the ends of justice exception. This court has held that mere sufficiency of the evidence is not enough to trigger the ends of justice exception. Specifically, the Commonwealth's failure to, you know, through inadvertence, to put on evidence is not enough for an ends of justice. Instead, there needs to be affirmative evidence in the record that the defendant did not commit the crime or was convicted of something that is not criminal. And here, the record, again, doesn't rise to that level. What we have is a possibility that the Commonwealth, you know, under the defendant's argument, did not follow the two witnesses rule, or that there wasn't one witness plus cooperation. I disagree with that for reasons that I will move on to shortly, but that is not sufficient in and of itself for the ends of justice exception. Instead, it's a mere sufficiency argument, which isn't quite enough for the ends of justice. As to the sufficiency of the evidence, Your Honor, I think that the document is very important. The trial court believed that the document, and I think found that the document had been altered, or could have been altered, or was altered, I guess is a better way to put it. The custodian of the records testified that about not only the account number, but the encounter number didn't match up with Mr. Winder and didn't match with the date of February 6th. And that, in fact, Mr. Winder had not been at Sentara Lee Hospital ever. I think that the court could and did give those facts great weight in determining the sufficiency of the evidence. as the trial court noted, as a matter of common sense, hospitals have a big interest in making sure that their records are accurate, both for liability purposes and billing purposes. And I think that's the kind of common sense thing that a trial court can consider. Furthermore, while the defendant argues that there were no direct witnesses who could come in and say we did or did not see him on February 6th from the hospital, any element of a crime can be proved by circumstantial evidence, and that's exactly what the Commonwealth relied on here. Here, the trial judge considered all the evidence and rejected the defendant's hypothesis of innocence, and I submit that should be affirmed. If the court has further questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Very well. I hear none.
I'm good.
Thank you very much, Ms. Johnson.
Thank you.
Mr. Seabock, your remaining 5 minutes, sir.
I'm on the clock. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
I put myself on mute so I wouldn't. You wouldn't be interrupted by my expressions of indignation. That's not a cut at Ms. Victoria, but in regular trials I do sometimes speak up. First of all, I just want to note that the idea that hospitals do not get billing wrong is laughable. I'm sorry. Everybody through their experience knows that hospitals get billing wrong. And
how
the only
the,
thing that
it, but how about the assertion that a search of the hospital record showed this patient had never been at that facility?
Well, that was never gone into sufficiently to know exactly why that came up. For all we know, they may have incorrectly put in his name originally, and so his records are there. They're just under the wrong name. You know, that would easily be the answer. They suppose they put in his name as Wander instead of Winder, and when they're looking for Winder, they don't find Winder. But if they look for Wander, they would have found Wander. There is no explanation for that, but the question is, did the Commonwealth meet its burden in proving beyond a reasonable doubt that he had committed perjury? And the only thing that they can say is, well, we checked our records, and we couldn't find it. We didn't go to, and again, my point is they did nothing to prove the fact. They didn't go to where the ER where he said he went and check any of the records there. Damn. Excuse me one second while I stop whoever's bothering me. Oh,
okay.
Might be another court. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is the law is very clear, that, and this is why our courts have established that you have to have two witnesses, because what we now have is one witness who is an attenuated witness, and a document where the only thing wrong with the document is the patient number. They don't say the date is wrong. They don't say the font. We are ascribing to Mr. Winder quite a great deal of skill in creating a document that is facially valid in every respect except for the patient number, and the point remains, it's not a patient number that doesn't exist. It is a real patient number, just the wrong one. So now we're saying that Mr. Winder must have found a patient number that actually existed and used that. That's quite a few leaps along the way for it to be the read that supports the failure to bring two witnesses.
Judge Decker, at this level,
I'm sorry.
At this juncture of appellate review, we view the record in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, and all of the speculation aside and arguments of reasonable hypotheses of innocence, those were all resolved at the trial court level, were they not?
Except none of this was raised at the trial court level, so the elements...
But that's the point. The record... We take the record as we find it.
All right. Well, I said that goes to my sufficiency argument, and I don't believe that the trial court's findings are, you know, it's a hard row to hoe, but the trial court's got to have a basis for making the finding that the document is fraudulent, and they don't have it. All they have is one inaccuracy in the document and the fact that the records custodian cannot find them based upon the fact that they may have made a mistake. But be that as it may, I understand the court's point. I would also note to the court that the Pior case, P-I-J-O-R, that the Commonwealth has pointed out, is not applicable to this case. It's a totally different argument with regard to collateral estoppel on a clear double jeopardy situation. I have not seen the brief that the Commonwealth has submitted to the Supreme Court of Virginia, and, of course, it has not been decided. And, of course, the PR case was decided that in favor of the defendant. But that deals with a different aspect of collateral estoppel, two different crimes, and whether one is subsumed by the other or not. Let's see.
Do you disagree that it would be in the best interest of everybody for this court to wait and see what the Supreme Court does in that case to determine I guess my question is, we don't know what the Supreme Court's going to say in that opinion. Doesn't it make sense to at least wait and see what the Supreme Court's going to say so that we don't create our own error inadvertently?
Well, let's put it this way. As long as I don't get an order saying I lose, I'm happy to wait. However, I would simply note to the court that looking at the Peor case, they don't decide the doctrine of collateral estoppel. Footnote 4 makes it very clear that they don't even address that in the aspect that we are discussing. The Peor case is simply not relevant to the issue that we're talking about, which is fact preclusion. The Peor case has to do, if I'm not mistaken, with the charging of stealing a dog, and that being dismissed, and then charging them again with stealing a dog, and continuing, whether it's a continuing single crime or whether they're two separate crimes, and therefore it's a double jeopardy issue. Now, collateral estoppel is a subset of double jeopardy, but our situation is fact preclusion. That brings me to, and I'm sure I'm running out of time, that brings me to what the trial court found with regard to the failure to appear. The Commonwealth's approach is somewhat unusual for them in that they're suggesting that the judge didn't think through why she was dismissing, and I say dismissing, the failure to appear charge in the original trial. They're suggesting that Judge Hall didn't give it any thought, that she just threw it away like some breadcrumb, whereas there was evidence and there were witnesses, and she made the decision. The fact that she did not articulate the exact reason doesn't change what one of the justices noted in today's argument, that the only fact about the failure to appear was that he wasn't in court, and the only defense that he proffered was that he was at the hospital. So if she didn't accept that as true, then she would not have dismissed the charge.
But see, Bob, isn't there a different way to look at that? Finding reasonable doubt can be tantamount to saying, well, I think you're probably lying, but I'm not certain beyond a reasonable doubt, so I'm going to find reasonable doubt and acquit you.
That's true. I mean, that is the way our system works, and I'm proud of our system, but by the same token, that's the only way it does work. In other words, it's very infrequent that you're going to have a trial court judge sit there and go through every fact and make a finding of specific fact on everything that's before them. It may happen and it may not. This failure to appear, though, is not the kind of thing where there are a whole variety of facts that are in play. There's only one fact in play, and that is where he was, and there was, as the court noted, one of the justices noted, there was only one defense place, and that was that he was at the hospital. And they tried to prove that it was not true, and the judge found that they had not carried their burden. She found that he was at the hospital. If he wasn't at the hospital, she would have had to have found him guilty, because that's what the charge was.
That's not necessarily true when something has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, is it, Mr. Seabach?
Well, that's the only way it can be in our system.
You can
find
it more likely than not that he wasn't at the hospital.
But that's not the standard. The standard is beyond a reasonable doubt.
That's exactly my point.
Right, and my point is that in our system, that's the standard that happens. If you find beyond a reasonable doubt that a person didn't do this or do that, what option is there other than that? What other thing can it be?
And Mr. Seabach, we do need to bring it to a close. You were right a couple of minutes ago when you said you were running out of time.
Well, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, you're fine. I think that we understand the positions that have been articulated by both sides. We appreciate the argument. The case is submitted. You'll be hearing from us shortly.
Thank you very much.